I thought one thing that I should do this morning, before I actually get into the matter of the parachurch, the church and the parachurch, and some of these things, that it might be helpful to you if I shared a little bit of my personal testimony. And I hadn't intended to do this, but when Ron stood up yesterday and shared a little of his, I thought, I need to share a little bit like that. I was born in a very small town or village of 100 people, right in the middle of the United States, in the state of Iowa. This town was composed of people that were almost exclusively Norwegian. In fact, my grandfather and all people of his age spoke Norwegian. And it was a total Norwegian community with one church in the middle. I didn't know there was any other church. I didn't even know it was named a Lutheran church. But it was just a church in the community. And as I grew up there, for the first 9 years of my life, I went to a one-room schoolhouse. And in my grade, there were about 20 children in this school, in the whole school, one teacher. And my grade had three students in it. When I left, two students graduated. That's how the turnover was. My parents were divorced when I was just an infant. And so I was effectively raised during that period of time by my grandfather, to whom I was very, very close, and my mother. So perhaps like in many Asian families, I grew up in an environment in which we had the entire family, rather than just for those first 9 years, rather than just my mother and my father. My mother remarried when I was about 8 years old, right at the end of World War II. And my stepfather and my mother and I then moved to a metropolis of Spokane, Washington. It was only 180,000 people. But to me, coming from a town of 100, it was a great shock to me personally, because that was just, it was just overwhelming almost. Incidentally, I had a Sunday school teacher in that little church in Garden City, Iowa, who is still alive today. She's about 94. And there is no person in the town or in the nearby farming area, it was a farming community, under the age of 70, whom she has not had in her five-year-old Sunday school class. And I believe she really knows the Lord, but I never heard the gospel, to my knowledge. When we moved out to Spokane, someone convinced me that I ought to go to a small Sunday school where a group of businessmen had gotten together and they'd formed this thing totally independent of any church. They'd just gone out into the recreation hall of a post-war world, post-war housing project in Spokane. You remember where it was, Ron? Garden Springs out there? And these places were very small. We moved in there. My dad, my stepfather, was going to a business college for about a year. And the house was extremely small, had a wood stove in the middle of it, rather primitive, really, but it was the right price at that time in 1946, $30 a month, I believe it was. But someone talked me into going to this little Sunday school. And through that Sunday school, I met a businessman by the name of Bob Shepler. Bob was a very independent, entrepreneurish businessman who did everything independent of everybody else, it seemed. He would not allow all that they were doing to be associated with any church, but it was really a mission outreach into a place that had no gospel witness at all, that housing project that I lived in. And it was through his consistent week-by-week teaching of the Scriptures that I came to know that I was a sinner and that Christ died for my sins. And so when I was about 12 years old, after an outing one time out to a lake north of Spokane, Washington, the fellow that Bob had helping him, a college student, he recruited these college students from a place called Whitworth College to help him, and the fellow asked if any of us would like to receive Christ, and I'd been thinking about it for over a year, and convicted, and received Christ as my personal Savior, sitting out in that car outside our home. Bob gave his life to us as a businessman. He took us swimming, fishing, hiking, and you name it. And he did it with us. He gave his entire life. He'd never had a bit of navigator training or background really at all. But somehow he sensed that you couldn't do lots of things well. So what he did was his business, and he gave his life to junior high kids. And he did everything he could. And it was hard for him. It was not easy. because when he was young, he'd had an infection in his hip. I suppose a little bit, Tom, except like yours, but much, it wasn't broken. It was a staph infection. And so Bob limped, and today, I just got a letter from his wife about a week ago, and I stay in very close touch with them, and they're one of our supporters. He cannot even walk. He's totally in a wheelchair. Just up to a year ago, he would have to be on crutches and dragging one foot. I remember sitting on his bed in his house a couple of 3 years ago, and he said, well, just pain all the time. And he said, it just takes guts to get out of bed in the morning. And he can't even go in. He's still a businessman. He still runs that store long distance from home. But he's a guy with great courage and determination. So I suppose my background is that of somebody who came out of the establishment, went out into an area, and reached out. Now, then he later related me back into a local fellowship in Spokane. And I became very active in the church and in young people's, but also in Youth for Christ. And during my high school years, I was very, very caught up in Youth for Christ and a leader in Youth for Christ. And it was during that time that I made some key lordship decisions, but I had a gnawing hunger inside my heart, knowing that I was not really in the Word, and I didn't know how to do it. And because our church was an evangelical church and everybody pushed people going into full-time ministry, everybody thought I should go into full-time ministry, and I felt I'd be a fraud to go into full-time ministry. And so when I won a Youth for Christ contest for something or another, I couldn't go to camp. And so they gave me the money instead, and I bought a slide rule and went off to the University of Washington to become an engineer. And there were some people that did not understand that. They thought I ought to go to Bible school or something of that nature. It's interesting. My home was very stable. My stepfather and my mother, it was a very good environment. I have no problem. The divorce really didn't have any that big of an impact because I had a stable environment all that time. And my mother came to know Christ. My stepfather came to know Christ. My real father later on and my stepmother, whom I got to know them later on, all have come to know Christ. And so I've been able to have a witness throughout my entire family structure. All my brothers and sisters from both families now have come to know the Lord. Bob was the man who, again, as I lived with him, worked for him in his business, and he was hard-nosed. I tell you, I have never worked for anybody as hard-nosed as he was in business. But he was the one that put me in his car, drove me 300 miles to the University of Washington, and the first man we met 28 years ago last month was a man by the name of Ron Ortley at the University of Washington in Seattle. And Ron and I became roommates. He was a senior in college, and I was a freshman. And I saw in Ron's life, though he was only 2 years old in the Lord, and I had known the Lord then about 8 years, active in church and all this, I saw something in Ron that I had not seen in others, except for Bob, perhaps. But Ron knew how to have a devotional time and get into the Word, and I found out he was in touch with the NAVS, and he started sharing with me, bit by bit, how to have a quiet time. We didn't do evangelism much in those days, so I didn't learn how to do evangelism. Later on, in 1958, I moved into Lee Sundstrom's home, which was the nav home in the area, just for a bit of time in the summer. But it was a time in the history of the navigators where I couldn't figure out what was happening. And I don't think that others could at some point either. It was a time of transition. Lee later left the navs. But I sensed their quality of life, even though there was not the thing that we would call training today. When I graduated from the university in 1959, and having been married quite young, against probably all navigator policy, we were married when I was 21 years old, and we went into the military, and through that time, Ron Ortley and I did man-to-man by tape recording. And so that was my only contact. I was always out away where there wasn't anyone to really be in touch with. Finally, in 1962, I got to a place where I was within about 80 or 90 miles of somebody. Bob Sparks was over in Columbus, Ohio. Bob Vedano would drive over a couple hundred miles from Bloomington, Indiana, to spend time with us at Dayton. I would get Jack Mayhall down from Chicago. But that was really the first time that we were able to get, as an adult, close in. And they were a great help to me in the ministry. And we had that at that time begun praying about going to the Air Force Academy in 1964. God, in many miraculous ways, led us there. And the Lord had prepared the way. Jimmy Chu and Warren Myers had been at the Glen with Warren working on the studies in Christian living, you may recall. And Jimmy was there for training. And they had had some contacts at the Air Force Academy. And we met together. Jimmy had already gone back. But Warren and I met with about seven men. And within 48 hours, I had an official entree into the Air Force Academy. I met with 500 students and proposed a Bible study under the auspices of the chaplains. And it was just an open door. And that class that we began still goes on today, 19 years later. And God has greatly blessed through that. And, of course, one of my motives for coming to the academy was to get more training with the navigators. I did not intend to go back for a Ph.D., but in praying about it, God really led that way to get more time at the academy because the navigators still were very suspicious, I think. They didn't think anything could come out of a place like an academy because they aren't available for so long afterwards. And that was part of it, and I felt that if I could stay there over a longer period of time, we could put a deeper root into it. And went back to Purdue University in 1966, and that is when Jack Mayhall, in fact, it was Carol Mayhall who appointed me to navigator staff, I found out. I went to a conference with them, and Carol said, "Welcome to the staff," and that's the first I ever knew about it. And so went on what we now call associate staff. At that point, we call regional staff, and remained in that situation back at the academy with Leroy until 1973, after 13 and a half years on active duty, when we really felt led to go full-time and begin functioning in a slightly different way. So that I wanted you to have a little of that background, especially my early background, which shows how God has used an individual to reach out into a very poor area. By the way, my stepfather was a truck driver for his entire life. My real father was a mechanic. Only in the latter years did he not work for somebody and had his own. Uneducated, my father had 1 year of that business college. I was the first one in my family to go to the university. So, Ron, I agree with you. God reaches down in anywhere and brings people out. And so I just praise God for the sovereign way that he has brought people into my life over the years. Not so much organizations, though those people were always related in some way. And God used them to help me grow and become what the Lord is making me into today. Now, for our two sessions today, I would like to make several suggestions. One is, I really suggest that you do not take notes. I'm going to cover a lot of material. Now, the majority of the material is contained in this book. And so I feel that you would be better off simply to write down occasional thoughts. You know, maybe if there's a golden nugget or an idea. But don't try to write down everything that I'm going to put up on the screen today, because I'm going to cover quite a bit of material. Particularly if you're operating in English as a second language, I believe you will be better off just to try and listen and follow. Secondly, I would like to emphasize that what is in that book is not navigator policy. That book is written for the broad Christian public to deal with the general question of organizations like ours and its relationship to the church. And so we ought not to feel in any way that it is what we must do, or that you must do. A third thing to remember is that in that book, I addressed it primarily to the United States, because you cannot write in one situation something that covers all cultures. So whatever you do with the material, you have to translate it into your circumstances. Now, what I'm going to share this morning in two sessions is first to go into some issues of history and then we'll have some questions. I want to see how God has worked over the ages. Secondly, we will go into the theology, and we'll get into some of the NAV identity, but I believe this theology, our identity must come out of a theology and out of the Bible. It cannot just come from out of the blue, though you'll find out later that there are a lot of freedoms that we have. Now, if in the process of my sharing, if you'd like me to repeat anything, please ask me to. If I get to speaking too fast, please let me know and say, hey, slow down just a bit. The other thing is that I ask your patience. I've never presented this publicly before. This is the first time, so it's as much experimental to me in verbally presenting it as it is to you. I've only written, and there's a big difference between writing and sharing something concisely in a short period of time that's meaningful. And so I feel, my feeling now is I have too much material. But I'm going to try and condense some of it. Now, generally, schedule-wise, what I'd like to do, it's 9:30 now, I'd like to take till about, I think it'll take till about 10:15 to present this first section to you, then take 15 minutes for questions, and then come back, you know, not take a real long coffee break, come back, because there will be more questions. The majority of your questions, I feel, will be after the second session. So I'd like to leave more times for questions and interaction after our second session. So that's a little bit of the pattern that I'd like to follow with you. So I hope we can manage today. First of all, I'd like to go to... Well, let me get organized here for just a moment. Let me not try and talk and organize at the same time. Yep, get these slides here so I can use them. The question comes up, first of all, what difference does history make? In fact, I was challenged just a few days ago with another NAV staff person questioning the use of history in what we do. And so I would like to share just a couple passages with you as we begin to set the stage for what we're going to do. Romans 15, 17. This little section is not in the book, by the way. In Romans, wait a minute, I think I wrote down... Romans 15... And help me out here. I've just goofed up the reference. On, well, 4, yes, 4, but that's on what was written. Remember those who led you, who spoke the word of God to you? Hebrews. Oh, I know. Okay, yeah, Hebrews. I'm sorry. How do you like? See, I told you this was experimental. Even though I skipped prayer meeting this morning, I had jotted some things down just separately. Yes, Hebrews 13, not Romans 15. First of all, Hebrews 13:7, remember those who led you, who spoke the word of God to you, and considering the outcome or result of their conduct, imitate their faith. Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, yes, and forever. Now, when the writer of Hebrews says that, I believe he not only means the Old Testament, but I think we look back on those leaders, how God has led men through the ages, through history. You recall at this point, he was talking about people who were not scriptural at that point. In that sense, they were not recorded in Scripture. He is talking about people. We often have applied this verse to think of, well, the person who leads me. But we are led through history in many ways. So that's one issue. Secondly, I would like to point out that the key word of, or one key word of the book of Deuteronomy is remember. Deuteronomy 6:12 says, be careful that you do not forget the Lord who brought you out of Egypt and out of the land of slavery. And then Deuteronomy 32:7, remember the days of old. Consider the generations long past. Ask your father and he will tell you, your elders, and they will explain to you. The Jewish people had a great sense of history. They looked back and saw how God had led. And if you'll recall, it's repeated again and again and again how God led them out of the promised land. So for us to go back and to look at history is not a bad thing to do. It's not an unscriptural thing to do. However, the thing to remember is history does not dictate what we do today. It shows how God led in the past and how God led people from the scriptures. So history is not determinative, but it is instructive. Does that make sense? History does not determine what we do, because history can be wrong. There are things in the scriptures, though the scripture records them as history, that we would not repeat, right? We would not want to live the evil life of some of the kings of the Old Testament. But yet they're in scripture, and we see them in perspective. We see that we learn from them. So with that as a bit of a background, I'd like to, first of all, take a look at the sweep of history. I'd like to give you an overview. And again, this is not in the book, but do not try and copy it. It's a little too complicated. What I want to do is to show you just the general trend of history. And if you want to copy this, you can do it later. I've just worked on this since I've been here. All right. First of all, have you ever been on a mountain peak? Okay. If you've been on a mountain peak, you say, I had a mountaintop experience. And I've tried to describe, Dwight helped me on this a little bit, and is thinking pictorially. I've been trying to think ever since we talked, Dwight, how I can picture this history pictorially. And so here is a sweep of history. And the higher the peak, the more it is close to what we would consider to be a biblical way of doing things. So let me just review the general sweep, and then I'll go back and go through some specifics with you. First of all, We have the Lord at the cross. Now, you notice I put that right down at the bottom because from the view of people, this was the end. But in God's eyes, and I've got it showing up here, it goes up and it is the highest point of all history. It's perfection. But you see, soon Paul and the apostles all saw that and began a tremendous period of missionary expansion. And through this period of missionary expansion, we found that the entire known world was reached. Then there began to be a decline, and it started to harden. And then we came through a period of great persecution in here, and just prior from about 200 to 300 AD. And then finally, Constantine declared Christianity as the official religion of the Roman Empire, and also at that time we had the canon of the New Testament put together. Then there was a further decline, and then I put a little peek here with Gregory the Great, who, though was not called a pope, was essentially the leader of Christianity throughout the Mediterranean at that time. And he did something that was really unusual. He sent missionaries. And he sent missionaries to England. And that was the first real thrust of out way away from the center of Christianity. We see the decline with Islam coming along in the near 600 AD. Then we have a terribly dark period in the history of Christianity, the Crusades and the Inquisition, spanning about 250 years. Then we see a little bright little spark of hope, a man by the name of Peter Waldo, and I'll mention him later. Then that seems to get forgotten for about 60, 70 years. And then up comes John Wycliffe, who was greatly persecuted. Peter tried to function in the system, actually went to Rome, Peter Waldo, and tried to get permission as a layman to preach. They finally granted it to him, but no one would actually ask him. And then with Wycliffe, and then a man by the name of John Huss. Then those men laid the foundation for the Reformation. I do not particularly agree from history that Luther was the key point. Luther simply was all disgusted and upset at the political issues of the Catholic Church, and he nailed his 95 theses fundamentally, most of which were not theological, but were more pragmatic. And in the process, through all his persecution that he received through that some of the political actions, he then discovered that it is by faith, by grace. And of course, the Reformation was born, but it was not just Luther. It was a man by the name of Zwingli and Calvin. And you even have to look at what was the counter-reformation in the Roman Catholic Church and the formation of a group called the Jesuits. And I'll mention a little bit more later. So that was rather a high point. But very quickly, it began to decline again. Because you see, the change was not all that great. And Lutheranism, along with what later resulted in the Church of England, or what you could almost refer to today as Anglo-Catholic, took upon themselves the formalism and the forms and began to deaden again. Now, there were many other things that happened in the middle of that, the Anabaptist movement, the Pietist movement, and some others that I will talk about in a few moments and that are included in the book. But let's move on. Right about 1698, I believe it was, the first missionary society was formed. And that began a process of awareness for missions. And then we came to an incident, primarily in Britain and the United States, that we call the Great Awakening. Men, and Dwight Moody was a result of that. A great surge of revival throughout the Western world, anyhow. And then we dropped off again, began a rise. Then there started to become great conflict between the conservative and liberal elements of Protestant Christianity. And in the midst of that, many independent missions and paralocal church groups were built, started sending. World War II then gave a great impetus. Those in the Western world were exposed to Asia, were exposed to Europe, were exposed to Africa, and their minds as Christians became inflamed with the needs worldwide, came back, went to Bible schools, the Navigators expanded, Young Life began, Youth for Christ started going, mission agencies apart from the church itself began to have a vitalization that we have not seen since, and sending missionaries out, and that continues through today. Now, in general, this is what it looks like. You had the infant church, then you had persecution, then there was structuring, hardening, deadening. Then we come to Reformation. Then there was retreat and formalism. Then we had the great age of missions and pioneering, the age of proliferation and expansion. Now, I'm going over that very fast just to give you the sweep, and I'm welcome. I'll be glad to leave this out, or even if we want to make copies. This is the one I told you I might have you draw up, and I didn't know how to have you draw it up. And then I'd like to just highlight Asia for just a moment. In Asia, since we're in Asia we came to the point where right about 600, a group called the Nestorians came into China. But they were run out very quickly within about a century later. Then Friar John came into China about 1100. And then Francisco Xavier came into Japan, Malaysia, and India. His life missions experience spanned only 10 years. It's incredible what God did through this man in only 10 years' time. And then we have the great missionary statesman William Carey thrusting out into India and sparking, in conjunction with this great awakening and the first missionary society. Then you have Hudson Taylor going to China, the China Inland Mission, the Protestant missions entering Japan, and the Cambridge Seven going out in the beginning of the student volunteer movement, and then Goforth going to Korea, who was a key person. So I just thought it would be good to highlight what happened in Asia. Now, most of the missionary expansion took place in Europe, and then later out of America. But the focus of much of it was Africa, India, and Asia. So that just gives you a sweep of history. Now, before I remove that and go to some detail,
do you have any questions?
You kind of see that sweep of history the way God has had, and I anticipate we'll have more of these ups and downs throughout our history. Okay? Now let's move on to discuss a little bit more about a historical perspective. Now, I'm coming back to today for a moment. Today, there are in existence somewhere between 5,000 and 20,000 paralocal church organizations. And so that we have our definitions together, I'd like to give you first a definition of the paralocal church and the church. Now, let me ask you not to write this down this time. I will leave it up during coffee break, and you can write it. It is in the book, but it's not as obvious. It's a little bit more obscured. First of all, the paralocal church, we will define, and that's on page 19 of the book, is any spiritual ministry whose organization is not under the control or authority of a local congregation. And I'll put this up again in a moment. Now, the second definition is for a local congregation, or what we call a church. It is a local community of believers of diverse age and socioeconomic strata who band together under a designated leadership structure for fellowship, teaching, worship, and outreach to the lost. Now, personally, I think I have to change that definition, but that's what's in the book. You know, you keep thinking, and you wish you'd put some other things in. I should have included missions. It's included in outreach to the lost, but I should have included missions in that. Okay, now, I am going to use the term para or alongside. Para means alongside the local church or the local congregation. Now, as we proceed through our account, there are somewhere between 5,000 and 20,000 of these kinds of organizations. But let me also remind you that today, according to actual statistics, there are 20,800 denominations in the world. And that's Protestant. I mean, I think that includes Catholic, but it would be listed as one. 20,800 identifiable denominations. So as we look at this whole issue of the church and the parachurch, we're dealing with a very complex thing. Now, as we look at the whole of history, we'll look at prior to 250 A.D., and I'm going to go very fast on this just to give you, this is going through this chart now in detail. The important part of this session is going to be the summary that I'm going to give at the end and an analysis. But let me just give you a little of the history. Prior to 250 A.D., we have the model of the Antioch Church in Acts 13. In Galatians 2, 1 through 10, we have another structure that you will see as people are reaching out. For instance, in Galatians 2, 1 to 10, we find Paul responding to the Jerusalem church saying this, "As for those who seem to be important, whatever they were makes no difference to me. God does not judge by external appearance. Those men added nothing to my message." It's interesting. He rejected the authority functionally of the Jerusalem church. And then later on, he confronted Peter, who it said was reputed to be a pillar of the church in Jerusalem. And he said to him that he added nothing to him. And then he confronted Peter for his personal hypocrisy. So Paul followed a rather indistinct line of authority. Just a comment. Paul is a pattern, but we must remember that Paul was a uniquely called apostle, who was as one born out of due time, he said. And his mission was, I believe, to be unique in history. Now, we can copy some of the methods that Paul used, but just because he used them does not mean that it was mandated or commanded. It's just like you cannot use Acts for all of your theology. But rather, we need to look a little bit more to the epistles. And he also had apostolic authority. But I simply want to point out here, they did not place themselves, that is Paul and Barnabas, under the specific authority of any church. That's debated by a couple people, but nevertheless, that's it. Now, as we go on to the age 250 to 290 A.D., we find out that the canon of the New Testament was brought together in 397. And in that intervening period, there were many heresies. There were many doctrinal debates. There were people going off in all kinds of directions. And if you read church history, you'll find that out. Christianity was legalized by Constantine in AD 313. And then a group called the Novatians were a group of people who in AD 251 looked more like some evangelicals. For instance, they called themselves the Cathatori, or the Puritans. That's not the right pronunciation. The Cathorori, Roi, or something like that. Someone will have to help me on my pronunciation. And they argued that the church had no power to grant forgiveness of sins. And they really opposed the current church. And they formed a network of small congregations and considered the Roman Catholic Church to be polluted. And then there was another division that was very similar to Luther. And it was in AD 350, a group called the Donatans. It was by Donatus, the bishop, was the man who led them. And this movement stood for a holy church, for church discipline, for unflinching resistance to immoral and unworthy bishops. And they said the Catholics had surrendered all of these by ordaining immoral priests and bishops. And they began a new group of their own. And so we see at this period of time many small groups coming out of the system. Then we move on, and by the way, almost all the time the issue was the purity of the gospel and authority. Those are the two key issues. And now at this time we saw the Roman Catholic Church grasping more and more for authority, structuring. And at this time, the Pope started to rise up, first as a religious leader and some very godly people, but secondly, as a political power. And so in AD 590 to 305, that large sweep of dark history, it began with Gregory the Great. And in 597, he brought 40 monks to England. And that began the process of missionizing or evangelization of Britain. Now, Gregory was the first one to be called what was referred to as a universal pope, the first time that the whole of the Christian Empire came under him. But after him, the pope was no longer just a spiritual leader, but he was an important political figure in all of Europe's politics. And notice how everything started moving from Africa and then and Middle East and moving northward into Rome and Europe, where the center of Christian power began to be Europe. And of course, that we found out that the Islam began in the 600s and swept in to large portions of North Africa and Southern Europe. The Roman Empire was formulated, essentially, the Holy Roman Empire, about AD 800, and then that dark period of history, the Crusades, began, spanned 1095 to 1291. They were not religious. They were political. But they were in the name of religion. Then there were several things that happened during this period of time. About the year 1000, a sect appeared in France. I believe it was France. I've got the names of the cities here, which denied the reality of miracles, the regenerative virtue of baptism, the presence of Christ in the Eucharist, and the efficacy of prayers to the saints. They were ignored for a time, then they were condemned as a sect, and then they were burned at the stake in 1023. Now, we wouldn't agree with all of what they said, but I want to point out that they tried to pull out, and they were persecuted. They tried to bring things. If you read that statement, you would say that's almost evangelical. Then Durant, who is a great historian, he told how many of these people were anti-clerical. Do you know what I mean by anti-clerical? That is anti the priest. They were not for that formal priesthood. And he said, he reports it like this. Some were harmless groups who gathered to read the Bible to one another in the vernacular without a priest, and to put it in their own interpretation upon it, their own interpretation upon its disputed passages. The Franciscan movement arose as such a sect and narrowly escaped being classed as heretical. Just lay people getting together to study the scriptures and find out what it meant without the authority, interpreting authority, of a priest. Then there was the man that I referred to earlier by the name of Peter Waldo. And he was in the area of 1140 to 1218. He was finally excommunicated, and many of his followers were martyred. Waldo had portions of the Bible translated into the vernacular French, and he taught a life of poverty and a pooling of resources for subsistence, rather a communal existence. And he went and tried to get licensed by the Pope Alexander III. His followers became devoted to the Bible, and they memorized large sections of the Bible by heart. And gradually, it took on an anti-sacrament tinge. In other words, that the sacraments, the communion and the mass and the baptism, that they were not needed for salvation. And they denied the validity, especially if it was administered by a sinful priest, and they attributed to every believer the ability to come to God himself for forgiveness of sins. And then they were called the Waldensians. And here's a quote about them. They were mere laymen. However, this is what Pope Alexander said. However, so he ruled, they could preach only by invitation of the bishops, a very unlikely prospect. Now, we note here the beginnings of not just a reformation, but this is key. We noted a movement of laymen carrying on a personal ministry outside the direct control and authority of the church. And I look back to Waldo as probably the primary beginning of what we would look at today as the para-local church movement. Virtually all of these people tried to stay within, but having been rejected, they moved outside the local church. One other that just ought to be noted is St. Francis, and he, in 1209, and by the way, he was a layman. He was not theologically trained. They called them the Little Brothers. They were looked down upon. They didn't have the training, you see, and they came to be the Franciscans, the servers. And they had a band of what was called Friars Minor. And, of course, the Catholic Church later brought them in as an order. During this period of time, which was 1300 to about 1650, we find several things happening. John Wycliffe led a succession of reformers who culminated with Luther. And what they wanted to do was to get the Bible in the language of the people. He instructed and sent out lay evangelists. Can you imagine? Untrained people. See, who had only the Bible. And he ran into great resistance. And it was very Calvinistic in his viewpoint. And his followers were known as the Lollards. Then later came the man by the name of John Huss of Bohemia. And he fought against indulgences, or that is, a priest being paid to forgive sins of someone. You see, that's what Luther was trying to push down. And they were a Protestant-like sect, and he declared that the church was all the saved, clergy and laity, the universal church. He was later imprisoned by Pope John the 23rd Now, you might say, wasn't there just a Pope John recently, the 23rd? Okay, Pope John the 23rd there was an anti-pope. This is a period of time when there were two popes, and the church today did not recognize that sequence of popes. But he was imprisoned by this man. And then finally came Martin Luther in the path of Wycliffe and Huss, and he fought for change, not separation. But it was all there, and Luther just lit the match to what had been happening, and the Reformation exploded. I'm not going to go into much of Luther, but just let me point out one other thing that was happening with a group called the Anabaptists. Lauderette says this: they traced its spiritual descent from some of the groups, usually of humble folk of Middle Ages, who, touched by the New Testament, attempted to reproduce what they believed to be the simplicity and the thoroughgoing commitment of life to the Christian ideal characteristics of Christians in apostolic times. Well, what is that but what many of the groups today are trying to do? They were trying to split the association of church and state, the politics from the church, and it was a lay movement again. Now, there were many others, and I'll just mention them. Zwingli in Switzerland, Calvin in French Germany and Switzerland, the Huguenots in France, the Puritans in England, John Knox in Scotland, the Anabaptists, and the Free Church. And all of these were people who tried to get laymen involved in their ministry. But then you come to another age just following that, and that is the age with the age of reason. Galileo, Newton, Kepler, science. All of these things began to come up, the age of reason. And in the midst of it, you got a group called the Pietists. The Pietists emphasized personal salvation, holiness of life, and the study of the Bible by laymen. Now, they had some very unusual things. They were the roots of a group called the Moravian Brethren. And they went off with a guy by the name of Zinzendorf, Count Ludwig von Zinzendorf, and formed communal, almost communist-like places where they drew people together, shared things in common. And sure, there were things that were mixed into the process, but again, it was laymen, and they were people who were trying to get lay people to do the work of the ministry. Incidentally, the Pietists never tried to make a denomination of their own. They scattered their people out into other denominations and existing churches. And it was in that time, in 1698, that the Society for Promoting Christian Knowledge was started. And then in 1701, the propagation of the gospel in foreign parts for the beginnings of missions. The Great Awakening began just shortly following that. Then missions with William Carey and the Baptist Missionary Society, the London Missionary Society, and the Student Volunteer Movement for Foreign Missions. I'd like to stop here for just a minute, and if we can alter our coffee break. See, I've never done this before. Let you stand. This is a lot of history, and then let's just stand and take about a 2-minute stretch break. I'm hot. I don't know whether you are. More groups together to thrust people out onto the mission field. And as they went on in time, they began to send student after student, and the great missionary movement came out of that particular movement. And again, the Christ was in this generation. Finally, in 1910, they had a large Edinburgh missionary conference, which he organized and chaired. And that was the cry. But in the years, now this is what I want you to listen to very carefully, and I'm going to read it directly from the book. But in the years following Edinburgh, the interest in foreign missions waned in most mainline denominations and the student volunteer movement. In its tension-filled meeting in Des Moines, Iowa in 1920, moved to take steps correcting this fateful fascination with the wonder and mystery of the Orient and sent them off to China and hypnotized their forebears. Out of sight of the sound and smell of the slums of Chicago or the injustices of the sweated labor. They wanted to concentrate on the visible, pressing social maladjustments at hand rather than the traditional questions of missionary work. Now, do you see the turning point? The turning point was when the liberal church that was becoming very liberal in the early 1900s said, listen, don't go out to the foreign fields. Don't thrust out into new areas. Look at our slums. Look at the poor here. Look at where we are. And they turned inward. And later on, Mott was very greatly maligned because they felt he was becoming liberal. The liberals and conservatives started splitting and splitting and splitting. But he was very conservative. But out of this group then came a new report called Rethinking Missions. Great academic work, but it basically came up with something that went like this. And I have to find it here, I'm sorry. Yes. They redefined the aim of missions as this: to see the best in other religions, to help the adherents of those religious to discover or rediscover all the best in their own traditions, to cooperate with the most active and vigorous elements in the other traditions in social reform and in the purification of religious expression. The aim should not be conversion. Now, folks, the thing I want to point out is from the period when this began in about, I've got to get the date here exactly, he died in 55, so about 1880 to 1920, 30 years span, the entire thrust was deadened by a misdirection of their aim and their purpose. John Mott kept true to that calling. He tried to remain above all the controversy going on, but he lost his effectiveness. And today, there is no such thing as the student volunteer movement for foreign missions. The greatest benefactors of that movement turned out to be the Baptists. They sort of picked up some of that mantle and began moving with it. So I just wanted to give you that little tidbit of what happened to one movement that started with such a great aim and ended in despair. It's sad. But really, missions went on. William Carey, Baptist missionary. Oh, that I've already gone through that. The China Inland Mission, 1865. The Regions Beyond Missionary Union, 1878. Central American Mission, 1890. Evangelical Alliance. African Inland Mission, Sudan Interior, the American Bible Society, American Sunday School Union, American Tract Society, YMCA, the Salvation Army, none of which were denominational. And most of which were lay-led. And then you had the Plymouth Brethren in 1835, and later in the early 1900s, the beginnings of Youth for Christ, Young Life, The Navigators, Campus Crusade, Jews for Jesus, Fellowship of Christian Athletes, and groups like the Institute in Basic Youth Conflicts. Now, if you will look, this is the growth of these paralocal church societies. Before 1860, hardly any. The black is, the white is sending agencies, that is foreign sending. And look at how it's almost exponential in these years. And the increase is incredible, and that is frightening the organized church today to see what is happening. Now, let me now share some observations, some summary and observations over the years on the church. Why did I go through this history? Okay, here is a summary of what I believe has happened. By the way, I want to just mention a couple things that Laterette points out, which I don't have on a slide. He points out three things in history, especially in the last two centuries. He says the rise and prominence of women's organizations for the spread of faith became significant in missions. Throughout all of this missionary thrust, women played a very primary role. We talk about the William Careys, but for instance, this book is written by a woman. There's a whole section in here on women in missions. Lottie Moon and various others, Mrs. C.T. Studd. And 60 to 70% of all missionaries have been women. It's significant, folks. We cannot ignore it. And then the second thing, he says, the missionary enterprise at the initiation of laymen was a new occurrence. And thirdly, the rapid increase of non-denominational society spurred the modern movement. Now, I won't go into the World War II issue, but the World War II clearly gave thrust to American missions particularly. And there were many things that happened there. But here are some summaries. First of all, conflict and division have been present throughout all church history. If you want to say, what's the hallmark of church history, I say it's conflict and division. It's terrible. It's unfortunate, but it's true. The second thing that we see is historically a resistance to any change in structure and practice, especially after the third century, it was crushed. Okay? Then there was institutionalization. After every new movement, the tendency was to institutionalize it and make it like a rubber stamp that goes bing, bing, bing throughout all time and history. Then there were few evangelicals during that time. Most, quote, what we would call evangelical movements were in the minority. But God always seemed to work through a little group of people here and there. The conflicts were doctrine, structure, and authority. Those were the main points of conflict through the years. Anything outside the existing structure or authority line was considered illegitimate and unbiblical. The other thing to note is most reforms began as change. They did not begin... Let me restate that. That wasn't stated well. Most changes or movements became as reforms rather than trying to split off. Groups did not try and just go start new groups, but they tried generally to change what was there because they were loyal. Then we also want to note that many reforms... Every report is right, just because Jen's structure didn't right. The other thing is that the results of these attempts resulted in one of three things. Either the reform took, that is, somebody listened and they changed, or it was crushed, usually by martyrdom, or they were separated and became a completely distinct system. This is all in the book, by the way, so I know you may be frustrated if you're trying to take some notes. The last few things to note is that many of the changes that took place usually were political and had political and social roots, not just religious roots. The other thing to note is right and existence are not the same. Right did not always win. The people who were right sometimes were crushed. So just because a movement existed or exists today does not inherently mean it's right. We have to go to the Bible for that. And the great lesson is God cannot be put in a box. He cannot be constrained. He will use diverse methods and peoples to accomplish His goal. Now let me make a couple observations on why the paralocal church groups have proliferated so greatly today. Okay, now, here's what I did with that history. I looked at the history, and I drew those conclusions. Those are factual conclusions that I just went through. I don't think anybody could say those are not what really happened. Okay, now, this is my opinion on why paralocal church and independent mission societies have become so big in the last two centuries. Particularly in the last century. First, it is the church's inability to use laymen and laywomen in full-time capacities. That's very key. A layman says, I want to serve God, and they say, what seminary are you going to? The second has to do with an independent spirit, both good and bad. You know, I don't want to be under any authority. I want to do my own thing. And so from Campus Crusade, from the navigators, from this group, from that, you have people just splintering out. Because people tend to not be able to work in harness with other people. I'm not saying it's good or bad. Sometimes it's good, but sometimes it's bad. The other thing that is precipitated is the United States tax laws. And that is, you can, in one day, you can incorporate as a nonprofit institution and have tax receipts. Whether we like it or not. I don't know. God obviously uses the United States tax laws to get some businesses things going too. The other thing is the whole idea of individualism of our age and what many call the American frontier spirit to reach out. That's there. If you read history, you'll see it. The other thing that's more significant is the unmet needs. That is, there are needs that are not being met by the local bodies and by the denominational structures. And finally, as many theologians have said, could it be God's initiative that brought these groups into being? That God moves in the heart of people, and people begin to minister, and then they form other people around them and go. No one really starts out wanting to have an organization, but they start out just to serve God. So there is a summary of history. You can critique this later. It's a little long, and it may be a little arduous at times, but I think we need to see how God has worked over the years. Now, it's 10:26. Why don't we take 5 minutes or so just for some questions now on this, then we can continue the questions, and then I'll go into the theology a little bit later. Okay? Yes.
Do you have any statistics that show or that would compare the church missionary outreach with the parachurch church?
Yes. There are quite a few of them. In fact, I've got it in the book, is that I'll have to use dates. I can look it up. But about right about 1970, the percentage of missionaries going out from churches was like 52% of missionaries came from denominational structures and 48% from independent mission agencies. That reversed 3 years later, and it's now the independent missions have taken the lead and are moving ahead. The denominational missions are pulling back, and without any question, independent, interdenominational mission societies have the clear lead in missions today. Yeah, there's some very good facts. The Mark publication from World Vision and some of the work that's been done at Fuller School of Missions. Yeah. Very definitely, the para-local church type of effort is in the lead in foreign missions today in terms of numbers of missionaries.
What kind of a lead would that be?
20%? No, it's slight. They're about several years behind in getting these statistics together, but I'd say by today it's probably not more than 54-46. See, there's a new surge in some denominations. For instance, the Presbyterians in the United States have split, and that whole Presbyterian denomination and what was the Southern Presbyterians are now forming new mission societies. And incidentally, we've even signed an agreement with one of them, and they will support navigators fully. A real breakthrough. John.
I read one just a history book. I do not remember the author. He said, God used, through church history, God used many movements, such as movement, a certain one, 30 years was the longest one, about 300 years can speak of it. And he said, certain movements, they dynamically start and structure. After that problem, and that death for just remain as a movement 30 years, or 50 years, or 90 years, and it disappears.
That's right. That is correct. I think in history would show that, but it's also the same relating to churches.
And I ask one thing. In your opinion, what's the navigator situation?
Well, in the navigators are no different in that sense. It, you know, it's kind of like a disease. And when you see signs of the disease, you either treat the disease or it takes its course. And there are many signs about it. It's that whole, it's the thrust of how we structure. See, are we going to allow some freedom, for instance? But yet, I think the more crucial issue is not the structure, but it's the aim. See, when you lose your aim, then structure, one thing, structure becomes meaningless, and the broadening creates a softness, and everything just sort of falls apart. Doesn't mean God isn't using that which is falling apart. New groups may form. I know of hardly any church, I'm talking about a local congregation, that has had an effective, dynamic ministry for more than 50 years. You know, my home church, Ron, and the one did you go to that one too? The one I did? First. It's dying. And it was once a great church in our city. And it's a rare church that remains dynamic. And the problem is the building stays there. With groups like the Navigators, when the people are gone, you don't have to worry about the carcass. But with a local congregation, you know, the structure tends to remain. So I would apply that statement not just to movements, but to movements of churches also, the Methodists being a primary example, certain aspects of the Presbyterian, certain aspects of the Baptists, and so forth. It's a statement that would apply to all of man's organizations. Tom?
Gary, in your analysis a while ago, he said that the thing that characterized church history is the conflict and the division.
Yes.
And expressed the feeling that it's not good. But looking at it from another perspective, wouldn't you say that conflict and division are inevitable and implicit in the growth of the church? Simply because of the spiritual reality that we're in. That invariably, as the church grows, the enemy would tend to divide and sow seeds of falsehood or
yes.
Untruth. And also, from the standpoint of effectiveness, that any time a group tends to grow too large, the inevitable is the hardening of the arteries, as it were. And therefore, the need for mobility. And so, division, in that sense, seems to be an inevitable process. So, I cannot say that, you know, from my viewpoint, that it is a bad thing. I think it's neutral, depending on, you know, the content and the situation at the time.
Well, yes, I could agree with that to an extent. Though disunity is not biblical, but it's real. That's about all that I can say. When I look at it pragmatically, I say yes, it will happen. When I look at it biblically, it is not according to God's best plan. That's all I can say on that, really. And I'll mention that a little bit in the next session too, Tom. One more question, then we'll break.
The terms that use the last sodality and modality, are those roughly synonymous with church and parachurch?
I'd like to delay that question because I'll treat it in detail in the next session. That's nice. How's that for a quick answer? Okay, I would like to just say, though I may speak strongly, because that's, you know, when you study things, you come up with convictions and you put them across and you communicate. I really want you to know that there's much more analysis that could be done. And all I've done is pick one thread of history. If we wanted to follow the local congregational thread, you'd find some other facts too. It's a mosaic or a puzzle that we need to put together and not look at one with tunnel vision and think that this is the only way that God operates. And so we need to have a breadth, but at the same time, we need to see how God leads us. Because that is some of the lessons of history. Knowing history in one's head is very different from seeing how it might give me some instruction as to both what I'm doing the organization in which I am and what we should do in the future.